It's the nuclear-powered Talking Mongoose edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, we'll check out quack tips from Calgary, interview from Wi-Fi researchers in Maple Ridge, Tokyo earthquake, and much more. Now let's start episode 106.
Ooh, I bet you're wondering how I knew about your plans to make me blue with some other guy you knew before. Between the two of us, guys, you know I love you more. It took me by surprise, I must say, when I found out yesterday. Don't you know that I heard through the grapevine? Not much longer would you be mine. Oh, I heard it through the grapevine. Oh, I'm just about to lose my mind. Honey, honey, well.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and also heard on CFBX in Kamloops. My name is Ethan, your free-thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science and philosopher. So Ethan, how's been your week?
You know, it's been a fine week. Fine for me, bad for... well, a good portion of the population of the world, unfortunately.
Yes, yes. If we're talking about people being killed in the Middle East, and on top of that now, this natural/man-made disaster in Tokyo, which we're going to talk more about later in the show, it's been horrible, except for us. And even I was stunned to find out that there was a tsunami alert. For us here in Vancouver. And of course, just to show you that curiosity can kill, apparently some people in California heard about the tsunami and thought they'd go down to the beach to see it come in California. Five of them went down, four of them came out. So you just, if they say stay away from the beach, probably stay away from the beach.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I think. But, you know, great show today here on Radio Freethinker. You know, last week we were talking about talking animals, and we kind of ended before I could get to my favorite talking animal of all time.
You know, I know he's been so itching to talk. I don't know what you have for this particular rodent. Well, it's not really a rodent. Is there, it's part
I don't
of
know.
Family?
Probably okay. A rodent.
Tell us about this wonderful story. Get it off your chest.
Yes, Geff, the talking mongoose. You know, Geff. G-E-F. I know, funny name. For a talking mongoose, of all things. You know, I learned about Geff back when I was in grade school. We used to get these books from our library, and they were these sort of like monster books, and they had the appropriate titles like Monsters, Ghosts, UFOs. And I blame these books for getting me interested in the supernatural when
and
I was
one of them
young.
Was called Geff.
No, one was just called Monsters, and in the book Monsters, there was a section on Geff. And so Geff is this reportedly talking mongoose that lived at a farmhouse near Gashin's Gap, near the hamlet of Dalby in the Isle of Man. And the story goes that the Irving family, consisting of James, Margaret, and their 13-year-old daughter, Vori, heard persistent scratching and noises behind the farmhouse, into the walls and everywhere. They had rats. But then they started to hear weird sounds, like kind of talking sounds. And eventually they discovered that they had a talking mongoose who soon revealed itself as Geff, who claimed to have been born in New Delhi, India in 1852. And this is all according to the young daughter, Vore, who was the only person to ever see Geff. He claimed he was a small rat-sized rodent with yellowish fur and a large bushy tail. And for the record, the Indian mongoose is actually much larger than a rat and does not have a bushy tail. So maybe Geff was a liar. He claimed to be an extra clever mongoose, also an earthbound spirit, and a ghost in the form of a weasel. He was once reported to have said, "I am a freak. I have hands and I have feet. And if you saw me, you'd faint. You'd be petrified, mummified, turned into stone, or a pillar of salt." He is generally depicted to be a mischievous creature who played pranks on people, got into trouble, and had supernatural powers. He would often spy on the neighbors and report their actions back to the Irvings, and all kinds of weird, mysterious things. Apparently, James Irving even kept a diary about Gep between 1932 and 1935, and these diaries, along with other reports about the case, can be found in Harry Price's archives and the Senate House Library of the University of London. We should get Rob to check that out for
yes,
us.
Yes, we should. Rob, if you're listening, go to the library.
And look up the talking mongoose, and they will think you're crazy. But they won't be, because they're there. So the Irvings left their house in 1937, and apparently they had to sell it because the house's value had decreased because it was purported to be haunted. And then in 1946, Leslie Graham, the farmer who bought their house, claimed that he had shot and killed Geff. The body that was displayed by Graham, however, was black and white and much larger than the actual mongoose that they had been discussing. Irving died in 2005. In an interview published late in life, she maintained that Geff was not her creation and, in fact, was real. However, that, of course, is contrary to most of the evidence that was discovered about Geff.
You know what I find very interesting? As a malevolent spirit, I never knew they gave you multiple choice when it came to what kind of thing. And of the multiple choices, what was it you said there? That you may either A, faint, B, be putrefied, C, be mummified, D, be turned into stone, or E, turned into salt.
Yeah.
Which one would I choose, assuming I had to choose? I think fainting of all those is like, I just thought that and he says he's clever. I'm not sure if that was really a clever thing, unless he was trying to slip it in there.
Well, yeah, I read a few analysis. I think Joe Nickel actually wrote a brief bio of him in an episode of Skeptical Inquirer. And generally, most sort of psychic detectives believe that Geff was some kind of poltergeist that befriended the little girl. Although I think that's perhaps putting a bit too much faith in a young woman's testimony about a talking animal.
Well, wasn't there something similar to this in a way with Arthur Conan Doyle and fairies in the forest? Or his daughters or something had said that they'd seen fairies, and that's probably a much more elaborate hoax. But still, children making up imaginary animals that talk to them. Is that a first time that's ever happened in history, or is this something that may have reoccurred?
I would gamble.
Hold it, Ethan. My imaginary friend Bob wants to answer.
Oh, go ahead, Bob.
He says yes.
Okay, well, Bob agrees, and I generally agree with Bob. He's a pretty smart guy. But speaking of other, smart things.
Yes, well, we had a tip from a loyal listener, thanks, Dean, about a report on Calgary's Global TV Health FYI website. He brought to us one of their little episodes to our attention about emotional healing. The premise of this quote-unquote therapy is to activate acupuncture to release body's energy. In the report it says, a quote, a mind-body technique focused on breathing exercises, positive imagery, and tapping on 14 acupuncture points while repeating positive affirmations. The segment is focused on a Dr. Pratt. No, I didn't make up that name. He really is a Pratt. who believes that ancient wisdom combined with modern science explains the success of his treatment. Oddly enough, in the report, they do some, red flag issues, right? They make appeals to authority by pointing out that he's written 3 books, none of which seem to be much more than the woo that we are typically associated with. And he himself actually makes an appeal to authority by stating at the end of the article that his treatments similar to his are being used by prestigious hospitals to treat post-traumatic stress. Of course, the story just kind of ends there. There's no sources. There's no leaks, right? The thing that I think bothered Dean, and especially myself, is that the segment was sort of passing it off as a health informational. In fact, I know people that I know watched it and assumed that this was some kind of genuine objective reporting because it was on TV. It had to be, right? But really, it was much more just an infomercial for Pratt, his books, his website, his seminar. He makes lots of money off of this sort of technique. There was no critical assessment. In fact, the reporter, if I can stretch the meaning of that word beyond recognition, states that there were some critics, but that, she says, in the brain scans, you can see changes after treatment. Well, at least according to Pratt, who she's just sort of parroting everything he says as true without, again, providing any sort of objectivity, any sort of peer review. And the only actually evidence they kind of provide is anecdotal evidence from a woman who was suffering from heartbreak. You know, I mean, the techniques that they were using, you know, positive affirmations, breathing, meditation, do, you know, cause reduction of stress and all that. There's nothing hokey-pokey about that. But adding this, you know, acupuncture, pressure points are just ways to scam people. Oddly enough, though, when I was checking out this article, I noticed a few articles down that they did one on the cell phone's effect on the brain. Now, if you remember, we did a bit on that last episode. But I was stunned at how misleading this reporting was. The story started off with an intro that said, it's always been a concern about cell phones. Is using them harmful for your health? Dum dum dum. Okay, I'm adding the dum 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 bit, but but then it goes on, and it actually isn't so bad. It says that there are some interesting effects were shown, but by beginning that the way, it's doing something called priming. So instead of being objective when you listen or when they report, you now have the viewers are sitting there thinking, oh, what are the potential health effects to all this, right? The report also states that. That it was the first evidence to show influence of cell phone, quote-unquote, radiation on the brain. And then it does this sort of weird thing. It states that the study's head, Dr. Volka, said that there was no health risk. She goes out and says, no, there's no health risk. Remember, we talked that she went head over heels about that. But then right after that, they state that she still plans to change how she uses cell phones. And then it has a clip of her saying, well, you know, people can use a wired earphone or they can just text, right? Of course, if they continued what she was saying, she also said that she's a neurotic and hypochondriac and that she knows she doesn't have to do any of this, but it's just part of her paranoia that she does this. So they're kind of taking it out of context. She doesn't really think there's a risk there, but she's just neurotic about these sort of things, right? Mm-hmm. Then they go on, they state that they do, unlike the other one, have other experts who say that we shouldn't be concerned, including, and they sort of end on the critics, leading industry manufacturers. Again, one of those things because you can never trust big industry, so how credible is this criticism? And then it ends the segment by saying, but many people remain concerned. This latest finding calls for more research, feeding a concern that shows no signs of letting up. Why are they concerned? Maybe because of reporting like this.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was disturbing. I mean, we often pick on the Georgia Strait, our own local sort of quack utopia, but it seems like global, at least the Calgary edition, I haven't had a chance to check to see whether this has been proliferated amongst other ones, are doing the same thing all over. It just, poor journalism.
Selling newspapers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to sell more newspapers by saying cell phones cause cancer than, you know, carefully reviewed scientific evidence says cell phones are perfectly safe.
And, you know, and the first one about the tap therapy thing, right, is lazy journalism. It's much easier just to parrot a press release than it is to actually try and do some kind of research.
Absolutely. Well, why don't we go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinking? When we come back, we're going to have an interview with Dennis and Melanie Stoiber on the Wi-Fi hysteria that erupted in Maple Ridge. Stay tuned.
It's our pledge drive here on NPR, and we have a 20-minute field recording of a tumluku, which is a Bosnian instrument which can only be played when you have a pierced scrotum and three kids who have been killed by a landmine. It's unlistenable radio! You understand me?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Totally listenable radio.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver.
Your Friends of CITR card will get you discounts on Main Street at Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear,
Woo Vintage,
The Kiss Store, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl,
Flaming Angels Boutique,
and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is Dennis and Melanie Stoiber from skepparents.org and a recent skeptical activist in Maple Ridge, British Columbia. Dennis, Melanie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So listeners know that we talked about the Wi-Fi issue in Maple Ridge last week, but why don't we recap the situation anyway? So what was going on in Maple Ridge that had you concerned as skeptical parents?
Well, basically over the last few weeks, we had seen some articles in the local newspaper leading up to a forum sort of discussing the issue of potentially banning Wi-Fi in Maple Ridge schools, or at least a couple of Maple Ridge schools. And they were pretty emotionally charged articles, very one-sided, and that sort of kind of, you know, piqued our interest right away because the science wasn't sort of being presented up behind it. So that's how we got involved to begin with.
So there was going to be a discussion that was going to go on, and you were concerned about the science aspect. Who was representing the anti-Wi-Fi point of view?
Well, that's the thing. That was our whole problem with the forum. There really wasn't anyone representing science. It appeared to be more of a lecture to promote the anti-Wi-Fi movement. And that's pretty much where we stepped in by sending a letter to our local MLA, Michael Sather, and then it just went from there.
And what was his response when you said that the science wasn't getting represented?
He agreed with us that the science wasn't represented. He sent us an email saying that he tried to contact, for instance, Health Canada, Industry Canada, Bell, Telus, Rogers, and I guess nobody really stepped up to the plate to represent the science side.
And so you contacted CFI Vancouver for some skeptical expertise, and was Mr. Thather interested in having CFI Vancouver represent the science side?
His office was very receptive to having the science side, yes.
And as I understand it, he also invited you guys to speak as well?
Correct. Actually, he had originally asked me if I had wanted to give a presentation, and knowing, you know, that I really couldn't sort of present that as it should be presented because I'm not a scientist or a researcher, that's when we said that, yes, we wanted to get involved, and that's exactly when we contacted CFI Vancouver for some advice and or references, help, etc. And they stepped up. Mm-hmm.
So how did the discussion go?
Well, it was a little hostile. There were a large number of representatives for the anti-Wi-Fi movement. It seems like it's just a small traveling group that hits all the venues, same people that we've seen several times before. And then Just two representatives on the side of science. We were extremely outnumbered on the panel and in the audience.
And what were the anti-Wi-Fi people, what were their arguments? What were they trying to explain?
Well, there was a number of things they were trying to explain. It was a lot of pseudoscience thrown at us. A lot of fast talk, and I strongly believe a lot of sale pitching as well. It seems like they have a bit of an investment in their speeches. I'd love to give you some examples if I could.
Sure.
There was one gentleman. His name is Farron Landers from Electropollution Consultants on the panel. And if you look up his name, or you can come to our website and click on a link that will direct you to a video, and he's actually selling a magic wand that measures the energetic health status of each meridian in the body. These people were just steeped in pseudoscience. It was almost painful to listen to.
Wow. What was the audience's reaction when they found out he was selling magic wands?
They weren't actually presented with that information, unfortunately. You would have to dig a little bit deeper than that. Although he did have a few items on the table in front of him that looked to me to be some sort of metal discs that perhaps might, and I've heard of these before, you know, absorb the negative radio frequencies, etc. So he did have a little bit of paraphernalia with him. Other speakers on the panel, sort of headlining speakers, there were two main ones. One was from the Citizens for Safe Technology, Una St. Clair Moniz. And her argument regarding this, or her sort of take on the whole thing, is that all of this is very untested, which is completely untrue. In fact, it's sort of one of the most tested effects on living tissue in the history of things that they've studied, as we were told by Dr. Rob Tarswell. Another main panel speaker was Curtis Bennett, and his sort of biggest claim is that there's an error in Canada's safety codes, that, you know, they're not taking something into consideration, that he happens to be the only one that's sort of found out. So, you know, and that this is what's really, really sort of breaking down our children's DNA structures, and it was just a lot of fear-mongering, really.
We should add, too, that Curtis Bennett, his claim is that he's an expert electrician. He really has no credentials. In fact, reading one of his sales pitches sounded more like a resume. He says he's, what does it say here, a government-trained electrical professional certified by provincial and national standards, which, as far as I can see, is no more than a journeyman. So I don't know what these guys are trying to sell here. This is crazy.
And what did the audience think of their presentation?
I think they were, unfortunately, I think it had quite an impact on them. They appreciated it. I didn't sort of see, other than the people that it's sort of come out from CFI and, you know, maybe a few other people, unfortunately, there was a little bit more support for that side. They looked afraid and they looked quite affected, unfortunately, in a negative way from what they had to say.
I understand there was like a Q&A as well. Did you get a good read on the Q&A from was the science getting through to anyone, or was it all just fear-mongering?
Well, there was a great representation on the side of science. Again, it was mostly CFI members that made an appearance, and they were just amazing at the Q&A. They seemed to dominate in the questions. And again, they were hugely outnumbered.
Yeah, Patrick Walden as well, a nuclear physicist, had also come out and sort of gave his take on it at the Q&A, more not really asking so many questions, but definitely giving some excellent information and backing up everything that Dr. Tarswell had said. And the questions that came forth from the CFI volunteers, they were very, very science-based, and they were excellent questions. And they really, unfortunately, didn't get straight answers. They were quite dodged in many cases, but it definitely brought the science forward. So if somebody was open-minded, there was a lot of information there that, you know, would definitely support the science behind keeping Wi-Fi in schools.
So what was the end result? What's going to happen next for Wi-Fi?
Well, I guess that remains to be seen. We're going to have to follow up with the MLA and see what he has to say about it, because it ultimately comes down to the political decision. It's not a decision that a scientist makes, unfortunately. It's just a process where the politician, Michael Sather in this case, will have to make the decision.
And the Wi-Fi debate was what motivated you guys to start skepticparent.org, is that right?
Well, basically, we had sort of been toying around with starting skepparents.org and skepkids.org for quite a while, because, you know, we're sort of very interested in this movement. We've got children of our own, and this just happened to be just such an excellent opportunity to jumpstart it with some great information, and basically to get it out there, because you know we're looking for support. This isn't something that we want to run alone. You know, we want to have contributors. I mean, this is an excellent community. We found support in the skeptical community like nothing else, and you know, definitely this was the jumpstart of it for sure.
If anyone's looking to contribute their stories or their, you know, their helpful hints or their knowledge, there's a lot of people out there that are a lot smarter than us. We'd love to have some contributing writers.
There is a sort of national debate about Wi-Fi that's going on as well, and it has been making the rounds of the skeptical community. And it's nice to see that when it does pop up on the local level, there are people who are willing to defend science and promote the skeptical agenda. Good science and a useful technology available to people who need it.
Absolutely.
Agreed.
Dennis, Melanie, thanks for stopping by to tell us about the event, and I'm glad that skepticism was represented. I hope that the matter gets resolved in a way that's beneficial for everyone involved. Hopefully you guys can keep us informed and let us know when a decision gets made.
We will do so.
Thank you for having us.
All right, well, thanks again, and best of luck with it.
Thank you, Ethan.
Thanks.
Computers, computers, computers.
Computers from the UBC bookstore are cheaper thanks to their student pricing.
This is the innovative solution to your computation necessities.
Including Apple products.
Imagine the savings.
Get yours before you graduate from UBC.
When you graduate, you will no longer be able to take advantage of student pricing.
Visit them today at the corner of East Mall and University Boulevard on UBC campus.
Spend the money you save on yourself. You deserve it.
Go online and search UBC Bookstore on Facebook and Twitter.
The state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a cry. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Bread and Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver, CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And welcome back to Radio Free Thinker here on CITR. So,
it was very uplifting to see that we're not the only skeptics trying to kill the Wi-Fi hysteria.
That's true, yeah.
Actually, I guess we always knew there was a bunch of them out there. But kudos to people who are trying to motivate and activate.
Absolutely.
Speaking of motivating and activating.
Yeah, speaking about.
Last week, we talked about the popular uprising in Libya and the possibility that the world powers may erect a no-fly zone over Libya to level the battlefield between the heavily armed forces of Gaddafi and those of the newly recognized government in Benghazi. I mentioned then that the U.S. and the Western powers were in kind of a catch-22. They could enforce a no-fly zone and then have people sit there and say, ah, it's just another attempt of the West to capture more Arab oil. Although the Arab League last Saturday came out in support of the no-fly zone. Or they could do nothing and then have these same people sit back and you see, if it was white people, you'd set up a no-fly zone, but brown people, you don't care if they die. Well, as it turns out, there is a sort of international law, well, sort of a UN protocol, that provides support for the UN to enforce a no-fly zone provided it meets certain criteria, called the Responsibility to Protect. It has three main clauses. A state has a responsibility to protect its population from genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing. If a state is unable to protect its population on its own, the international community has a responsibility to step in and assist that state. And thirdly, if a state is manifestly failing to protect its citizens from mass atrocities, the international community has a responsibility to intervene to the point, and as a last resort, with military forces. So the first one essentially says that a state has responsibility to not kill, the state has responsibility to ensure that its own population isn't being killed. The second one says that if a state's unable to prevent a large population from being killed, the international community can step in and help. And the third one says that if a state is killing its own population, the international community has the right to step in and protect the civilian population. It seems clear to me, at least, that this is a situation in Libya. And although it may look bad, lives are being lost, and the world should step in and take responsibility and act. Okay, that's political speech. Now let's get a little skeptical. First, the rules claim that genocide or ethnic cleansing need to be happening. Is this the case? Well, Libya is a very tribal society, and the fighting does appear to be largely along tribal lines. However, there does not appear to be any attempt to, and this is part of what ethnic cleansing or genocide is, there's no attempt to remove or kill an ethnic group from a geographical area. It is factional fighting, but so far limited to combatants and political reprisals, but not really genocide. Okay, what about crimes against humanity? What are crimes against humanity? Simply, they are acts that violate human rights on a grand scale. Acts such as murder, committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack directed against any civilian population. Acts reach a threshold of crimes against humanity only if they are part of a widespread and systematic practice. Essentially, they are not intended to be sporadic or isolated incidences. That is, a few people being killed here and there. It's just part of normal politics, I guess. But when it becomes large mass populations, then it qualifies as crimes against humanity. I am unclear, though, if Libya qualifies. Well, at least, you know, from the current state of events. Because the crimes against humanity are largely assessed in times of peace or occupation, and neither one of those really seem to be applicable here. I mean, it's in a state of war, civil war, right? So, what about war crimes? What is the law of war? It is not really that well defined. But the best example I could find is something called the International Humanitarian Law. To those of us a bit more simply, think of it as the Geneva Conventions, although that's more of a old style version of it. Of these, the only one that seemed applicable was that captured combatants and civilians must be protected against acts of violence and reprisal, which, of course, again, in this context, seems to be happening quite a bit. But it's complicated because war crimes technically are between two nation states. And as I say, this is a civil war, which makes it a bit fuzzy. I think there's more than enough justification for the act of responsibility to protect to take effect. But it's not quite the clear-cut case that I thought it would be when I first said, oh, obviously, people are dying, you have to step in. And there's also, of course, the old issue of precedent. Once you do it here, you're sort of morally obligated to do it in other places. I mean, it has been used before. Darfur, it was used as justification. And, of course, it was all created because of what happened in Yugoslavia. That was the main instigator of it. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, Ethan?
Not really, no.
Okay. So let's move on then. We hope our listeners may have some comments about this, and if they do, they can send us an email. We're still going to stick with the radio.freethinker@gmail.com, although we're working on getting our own email set up. Hopefully by next episode we'll have that all ready, and you can be sending your information directly to us and not through the big mega corporation of Google.
We all know that Google has some very ulterior motives when it comes to intercepting our emails. So as I think every listener knows, there was a massive earthquake off the coast of Japan recently, causing a very massive tsunami, which caused much destruction. And now it appears that they have another problem, and that is related to their nuclear reactors.
Yeah, well, you know, like it's like the events were quite weird. I mean, like they suffered this huge thing, right? It was a 1-2 punch sort of by nature, right? They had the huge earthquake, huge tsunami. And as a result, on top of that, now they have a bunch of incidences with their nuclear reactors. So what sort of happened? Well, the Sendai earthquake hit about 130 kilometers off the Japanese coast on February 11th. It was a megathrust earthquake, meaning a large portion of the subduction plate suddenly slipped, causing a big upward shift in one of the plates. This upward thrust, of course, caused a tsunami up to 10 meters in height. That's like 33 feet. Wow. That struck the coast of Tokyo, including this area where the nuclear power plants are. The quakes caused the Japanese nuclear power plants to automatically shut down. Japan, as most of us know, is a rather earthquake-prone zone, and they have engineered their nuclear power plants to take this into consideration. So the nuclear plants had shut down, and they were no longer doing their nuclear things. But, of course, they were very hot, because the whole point, whole reason, the way that nuclear power plants work is they boil water. So they have to get very, very hot. You put water through, turns into steam, runs turbines. So even though the nuclear reactions were stopped, they were still very, very hot, and it takes days to cool down these reactors. The type of reactors that can be found at the Fukushima nuclear power plant, that's the one that we've all been talking about, were constructed in the 70s, and they used water cooling pumps to circulate water around the reactor. The pump's power supplies come in three levels of redundancy. So first, it takes power from the grid, which ironically enough, because they shut down the nuclear power plant, was no longer there. Second, they have diesel engines, and then thirdly, they have battery backup. So the plant first lost, again, its main power when the earthquake hit. Then the tidal wave struck, which wiped out the diesel engines, which meant that the plant had to rely on battery power. But the battery power is only of a limited capacity, only lasts several hours. It was assumed or calculated that replacement engines could be brought in to replace the batteries when needed. However, they didn't factor in that the power couplings, or the plug-ins for the pumps, were in the basement, which, of course, because of the tsunami, were all flooded, so they couldn't actually get access when they did bring in these reactors. So they were unable to cool down the reactors. Now, many of you have heard there's been a bunch of explosions that have happened at the plant. These are not, I repeat, not nuclear explosions. These are hydrogen explosions. Now, you may ask, where did the hydrogen come from? Well, as the reactor core heats up, the water boils, it starts reacting with elements, oxidizing them essentially, and as oxygen is pulled out of the water, what's left behind is the hydrogen. This hydrogen builds up and will eventually explode, which is what we've seen happen. The explosions that resulted, we've seen on the TV and the internet, and they look quite, scary, and, well, okay, sorry. They are scary. I shouldn't underplay this that much. I mean, it is a horrific thing that's happened there. Although the containment vessels of the nuclear fuel haven't failed, well, they haven't failed yet, and we hope they never, well, correction, last I heard that it's possible that reactor number two's nuclear fuel vessel may have cracked. A lot of this is ongoing, and we're not 100% sure what's going on. But there's been no actual, from what we know, nuclear fuel released into the atmosphere. However, any element that's kept in near proximity to nuclear power will eventually itself become somewhat radioactive, sort of in the same way that you can induce magnetism in a metal spoon if you rub it against a magnet.
Right.
So what has been released so far through the explosions and steam, they've released some steam from the reactors in order to reduce the pressure within the containment vessels, has been tritium and nitrogen-16. There may be one or two other elements out there, but these are only ones I've been able to track down. And currently they're actually using seawater to keep the plants cool, which of course, ironically enough, ruins the nuclear cores because it corrodes them, and when this is all over, we're going to have a bunch of garbage left over that's going to have to be dealt with. So far, most of the attention has been on reactors 1 and 2. That is, of course, until Monday. Today, it seems due to the previous explosions in reactor 3, instability was caused in reactor's 4's building, causing it to collapse, and that in turn caused a fire in its fuel storage units, which has released radioactive steam and or smoke. Now, the fire is supposedly out again, there's some debate about whether this is. It also inadvertently caused reactors 2 cooling system, which up until this point had been functioning reasonably well, to go from poor to fail. And unlike the other ones, as I say, its containment vessel seems to have been compromised or at least deformed. The nuclear fuel itself is contained sort of within a sealed container, right? So that it's never ever actually exposed to the water. It's never actually exposed to the atmosphere. And so far, none of these ones have actually had the nuclear fuel exposed to the atmosphere. But in number 2, it looks like that might be the case. That being said, you quite often hear the term that the nuclear power rods have been exposed. And what does that mean? You go, oh no, the power rods, aren't those the things in the nuclear thing if they're exposed? Does that mean? Well, what they mean by that is that the inside the containment unit, the nuclear fuel is surrounded by water. And if that water lowers a certain level, the rods become exposed, which allow them to superheat up, and again, it's very dangerous, but they are still within a enclosed containment feature. So, that all being said, there has been, throughout this incident, a monitoring of radiation that shows, so far, only minor increases about what you get in an air flight, up until, like I say, this very last incident, where the background radiation within the plant went from something called 20 micron servets to 500 microserverts. Now, servet is just a standard unit of radiation exposure. It replaced what we used to call REMS, if anyone, right, REMS, REMS, yeah. And essentially, just for reference, an X-ray is about 4,000 microserverts. Now, the risks exposed by the nitrogen-16, which I said is one of the elements that has been released, it's quite minimal because it has a half-life of seconds, so it's not going to go anywhere. Another element that has been released is tritium, which has quite a longer life, but it's not dangerous to the human body externally because it can't actually penetrate the skin. Hmm. But if it does get ingested, if it does get breathed in, then actually it can cause some health issues. But it only has a lifespan in the body of about 14 days, so there's sort of short-term exposure issues there. Now, of course, it's still really too early to determine what the ultimate outflow will be of all this, but it does seem so far that although this is a horrible incident and there are going to be health risks, there are going to be a lot of other issues, by and large, they are dealing with them. And one of the things that hasn't been mentioned as much, because it's not nearly as sexy, it's not nearly as moot, is, I mean, there's a bunch of refineries that were on fire, releasing a lot of toxins into the air. I did a bit of research, and so far there are about three or four nuclear accidents every decade, which, again, horrible. Most of them, though, were internal contamination, i.e., if you worked in the plants, there may be a risk because a bit of nuclear fuel may have spilt in a place where it shouldn't have, or there's been a release of nuclear water where it shouldn't have, but all this was internal, or it's been tritium, which we've already talked before, which is something that should be addressed, but is not a huge incident, especially when you consider 3 or 4 in a decade. And you compare that to the hundreds, if not thousands, of accidents that occur in oil refineries. And I just stuck my research to oil refineries because that was a good one, which, although don't have any radioactive contamination, that's a big bugaboo for people, they do have a lot more chemical poisoning, including carcinogens. So comparing the ongoing risk between the two, this is a horrible event. And I think there's been a huge reaction across the planet about, well, let's stop any building. Let's review what we have done, right, just to make sure that our safety plans take into consideration what has happened. And I think those are all valid things to do. But those people are sitting there saying, see, nuclear power, it's going to destroy the planet. It's horrible. I think is a bit of an overreaction.
Well, one of the big problems with this has been the absolutely atrocious reporting that's been going on about this catastrophe. You get newspapers with headlines, you know, meltdown in progress and radioactive leak and all these sort of things, taking, I think in many cases, precautionary measures out of context. I mean, they've evacuated very large areas of the population. But I mean, again, it's not because there's an immediate danger, it's because it's a precaution in case a danger escalates.
And what would people have said if they, I mean, if nothing happens, if they didn't do this evacuation, someone would have said, well, you know, something could happen and you didn't evacuate the people. You put people in great, great risk. So you're right. They kind of have to go through this evacuation thing. And again, you know, it is a cost to the whole process. But I mean, these are good things in an odd sort of way because, you know, you're going, well, what is the worst case scenario?
Yeah.
Well, it's not quite at that point, but we're going through it. And it's not quite as bad as we thought, except, of course, the hype in that. In fact, I was watching an interesting interview with CNN's Cooper, and he was reporting he was 130 kilometers away from the nuclear power plant, and we know the exclusion zone's been about 20 kilometers. And they were talking about, well, there's been some steam released and some smoke released, and it's been, and he was sitting there saying, should I be here? Should I, you know, maybe I should leave? Am I in any risk? Which, of course, objectively, there was no risk, but you could see how there was just this playing up of sort of fear.
Mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. And the fact that there's been so much, I guess you could call it pseudoscience, it's leaking its way into the media as well. One of the sort of common fears was that if the plant does melt down, it's going to create this toxic cloud that's going to blow across the Pacific Ocean and waft over North America, which is completely and utterly wrong. It's just not going to happen. It's impossible for that to happen.
You know, and then you get the quack medicine come into it too,
yes.
Or pseudo-quack medicine, I should say. One of the things I was listening to on my trip here to the studio today was about the price of iodine pills, which have gone up apparently from like about $8 for a bottle to over $100 for a bottle, selling here in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And iodine is a treatment used for sort of heavy nuclear exposure. So if you were in the nuclear power plant, right, you'd want these because the number of radioactive elements that are there, in particular radioactive iodine, which is what it's supposed to protect,
right,
is valid. But no one in Canada, under the worst case, even these crazy people sort of things, would be exposed to radioactive iodine.
Yeah.
And but people are sitting there saying, hey, I heard it on the news, therefore I can make a buck and people's fears are
going rampant. Well, I mean, talk about making a buck. I just recently saw that our favorite homeopath, the daughter of the Georgia Strait owner, is selling homeopathic remedies for radiation poisoning because of this big toxic cloud that's going to sweep across North America. That's just blatant fear-mongering, borderlining on fraud.
Well, actually, no, you know what? I think this might be the one case where she may actually be giving up more than she thinks. A certain amount of all the water on the planet is something called heavy water, which is tritium, right? That's mm-hmm. It's why it's very rare to get a hold of, but it's still there. So it's conceivable that there is a molecule of tritium in her little homeopathic water, which I might point out would be a million times probably more concentrated than anything else she's ever claimed was in this water.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't taking homeopathic nuclear medication be like exposing yourself to a nuclear meltdown? I think it'd be actually quite horrible. But yeah, so I mean, the media reporting has been quite awful. It's been sort of a smorgasbord for peddlers of woo. And it's also been a source of real panic and dangerous situations in Japan. But, I mean, I think it's kind of clear from the real reporting that Japanese authorities are doing everything they can to contain this. And this is not really an indictment of the failures of nuclear power, but I think actually an indictment of, well, not, it's actually a testament to the heroic efforts of nuclear professionals trying to prevent a disaster.
And the fact that, I mean, a lot of the stuff has been well thought out and that no situation can be perfect. But, I mean, as you say, you know, out of the number of, Japan is littered with nuclear power plants. And the fact that these few have had some issues and none of them, as of yet, catastrophic. One of the reasons why I seem to be very hesitant or reticent to say, oh, not yet and all that, is because we got to be good skeptics. And as much as I love to jump on the nuclear bandwagon, because I think it is one of the ways to solve the Earth's greenhouse climate things, I don't do so blindly. I acknowledge there are risks, there are dangers to it. Everything has risks and dangers. So don't misconstrue my saying, not yet, could be, maybe, as sowing doubt. It's just being open to the fact that you have to be open to new evidence. Whereas the critics of the nuclear power plant I was listening to Democracy Now, which I love Democracy Now. It's one of my great things. And they had an advisor to the American Energy Board and an outspoken critic of nuclear power plants sitting there saying, this disaster could be the worst thing that's ever hit the planet, right? And I'm going, well, that's really too soon to say. And what purpose does it serve, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't think it is with anyone's intent to suggest that all the concerns are overblown. There are certainly not. I mean, there is real danger here, and everybody acknowledges that. But, you know, you look at some of the reporting, and they're calling it the next Chernobyl. Yeah. Well, first of all, it hasn't gotten to that point yet. If it does get to that point, okay, it's a disaster. But it's not even there yet. We're still trying to fix this problem. And the fact that we're able to, that this is fixable, is a testament to the amount of technology and the advancement that nuclear safety has undergone.
And you know another thing, too, that always strikes me as somewhat bizarre. Again, you know, I am a proponent of nuclear power, so I do have a slight bias here, but I acknowledge it's not a final solution. It is at best a stopgap. And a lot of the people who are against nuclear power say, oh, well, it's horrible. It's a risk. And what we should be doing is we should be funding, you know, alternative renewable energy resources like wind power and solar power, which, again, I agree, a great thing to do. But it always strikes me that we get the first part. We stop the nuclear power plants from being built, but we never manage to get the windmills built, and we still get stuck with having coal power plants, oil power plants, the tar sands, which a lot of people have complained that are going to be huge environmental impacts. It's just this sort of, all you ever do is criticize, mm-hmm. and you don't spend that energy promoting, you lose out. I mean, how many people have complained about the price of oil and say, I wish it was cheaper? Well, it could be cheaper if we subsidized it more, but if we subsidize it more, that takes away money from alternative sources of energy.
Absolutely. It's a difficult situation, and again, it's going to be developing by the hour as we go, so we don't know what we'll expect, but at the same time, you look at the hard work that these officials are putting into it, and we wish them all the best with that. We're pretty much out of time here on Radio Free Thinking. Let's go to our final commercial break, and we'll come back with our skeptical highlights after this.
Are you interested in radio, but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit CITR.ca for more information.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So let's move on to our skeptical highlights. And we've been talking about the disasters in Japan. It's a great time to consider donating if you have the means. And, you know, you don't need to be a billionaire to donate. Even, you know, a $5 donation to a science-based organization can really make a difference. Remember, at this time, there are a lot of scam artists out there who will try to take advantage of your donations. So make sure you're going through a reputable organization. The Red Cross, for example, is a very good organization. I'd like to promote a skeptical humanist organization called SHARE, which stands for Skeptics and Humanists Aid and Relief Effort. They're taking donations now to help deal with the disaster in Japan. Every dollar that you give to SHARE is sent directly to Doctors Without Borders, which is a wholly secular international organization. And this is, I think, kind of important because, as many non-believers know, we're often unfairly labeled as being selfish and not interested in donating to charity. This is a great opportunity to prove those who would say that wrong. You can find more information on SHARE at www.centerforinquiry.net and help donate to Japan.
And on a similar but related note, there's also a relief fund set up for those people in Libya by UNICEF. One of the things, you may have very different opinions about what's going on in Libya and all that, but UNICEF itself is focused on children and women with children in the area, and they've set up a relief fund. Libya itself is getting a lot worse than the other areas that have had turmoil, because it's on both sides of its borders, Tunisia and Egypt, which both themselves have gone through these sort of people's revolutions, which means they're not in any condition to take in the hundreds of thousands of refugees that are leaving Libya. So if you want to offer your support to that, you can go to unicef.ca/support_Libya, which is setting up donations for that. Now, UNICEF, although isn't strictly skeptical, is a non-religious-based group, so you can do so, support it with some degree of comfort, although it is part of one world government, but I like that, so that's sort of a good thing.
Yeah, sure, I suppose. Another skeptical highlight, this one is actually today at 6:30, but it's very important. The UBC Freethinkers are having their AGM, and that's today at 6:30 in the Buchanan Building, room B307. The club will be electing its new exec and making plans for events and activities. You know, this is actually really important. The UBC Freethinkers is the campus's only secular, skeptic, free thought club. I don't need to remind our listeners that there's about 50 religious clubs, and good for them, but you know, skeptics and freethinkers need to have their voice heard as well. Please come out. If you're able to volunteer or help run the club, please make every effort to do so. It's a great opportunity for meeting new people and just sort of advancing the cause.
You know, and it's really important in another way too, is that there have been other skeptic clubs at UBC in the past, and they have basically faded away, because one of the disadvantages a lot of skeptics have is we don't have these external money resources that the religious organizations do. The reason why there are 50 church organizations on here is because they have churches supporting them, trying to infiltrate into the campus, and the UBC Freethinkers needs people to realize that, you know, it's people power here at UBC, that in order for us to keep the skeptic torch alive, you need to go out and actually do something and not fall into the standard, oh, well, someone else will do it, or, yeah, I don't know if I really care sort of thing. Because if you do, they win. And we become more and more of a theocratic society, more and more the liberties that skeptics try to promote, more and more of the openness and scientific thought that we try and promote gets drowned out underneath the rash of dogma promoted by these other religious groups, which I think is a bad thing.
Absolutely. And you know, it's a great, great time for skeptics in Vancouver. The recent successes of CFI Vancouver and getting the word out there, the success of other groups in BC, the CFI group in the Okanagan, the Kamloops Rationalists, the SFU Skeptics, the UBC Freethinkers. I mean, it'd be a shame to let these groups sort of wither away. So it's really important that we do what we can to help support them. And again, you know, one great avenue of help for the campus groups is, you know, organizations like the Secular Student Alliance, which provides a lot of funding for campus groups to bring in speakers, to hold events, and a lot of their funding will come from membership fees, which are usually like $5 or something, and it's not that's nothing. You know, it's a cup of coffee, you know, so consider helping them out. And well, we feel like this is a big, long pitch for, like, giving money away at the end of Radio Freethinker.
Well, to a degree, but I mean, these are important issues. And again, to plug in the UBC Freethinkers Club, you know, it's local, it's here. And even if you don't need to donate the money, even if you think you can't quite afford it, your body showing up is enough. Just
absolutely,
to show support that we are the silent majority. Well, maybe not quite, but we're definitely a significant minority in society.
Absolutely. Well, reminder to all listeners, please email us at radio.freethinker@gmail.com. Check out our blog at www.radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. This is Ethan, your freethinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
Bye-bye, everybody.
It's our pledge drive here on NPR.